I know.
Yeah, that's right.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for March 18th on this bright sunny day. We only have about a dozen bills to work on today, so we should be able to get done early and go out in the sunshine. Hello. But we are going to start by opening an informational meeting on diabetes in Oregon, and I can't say how delighted I am to welcome Scott Brunback, our past representative, who as a member of this committee led the way on some important diabetes laws, and it's great to see you back, Representative Bruin.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Just want to make a few I'm Scott Bruin from Westland, Oregon. We're going to make a few comments about the state of diabetes in Oregon, but before we start, I want to introduce my daughter, Catherine Bruin, and she has a brief testimony that she wants to, so she gets herself squared away, wants to give her.
Please introduce yourself.
So I'm Katie Bruin. I'm a fifth grader at Trillium Creek Primary in Westland, Oregon. And yeah. So first, I would like to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here today. Thank you for supporting or about to be supporters of the American Diabetes Association's search for a cure. Diabetes is a disease that injures many Americans. I have been affected it for as long as I can remember. My dad has had type 1 for about 30 years and counting, but I was not completely affected until 7 months ago. I was on vacation in Central Oregon when I started showing early symptoms of diabetes, constantly going to the bathroom, having unquenchable thirst and craving sugar. On the last morning of our trip, my dad decided to check my blood sugar. It was well over 300 and definitely out of the normal range. We packed up and headed home, then got right back up and went to the hospital. The last 7 months since that have been frustrating, filled with staying up late to test my blood sugar just one more time and pretending I'm fine when I'm actually not. It would be impossible for a non-diabetic to know the pain diabetics go through every day. If we find a cure for this terrifying disease, no one will know that pain anymore. Thank you again for inviting us here today, and please help us find a cure. Yeah.
Any questions? That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. You're obviously headed for a place where, like your dad was. Personality will shine through.
Again, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. We're here with about 50 advocates today with the American Diabetes Association, sort of the Oregon and the Southwest Washington chapter. I'll tell you sort of our bigger scheme of things that we're working on, but let me give you just a little personal background. Mr. Chair, as you know, and some of the people I've worked with before know, and as Katie mentioned, I've had diabetes for about 31 years. In the course of those 31 years, I calculate I've given myself about 50,000 insulin shots and have taken about 79 or 80,000 and blood tests, so I'm well aerated at this point. But I do fine. You know, something years ago I was very active with, just sort of as a diabetes advocate, worked or served on a number of organizations, and then just as things do, you sort of slip away from things and go on to other interests until, of course, our daughter Katie was diagnosed this last summer. And I have to tell you, as she described that story, you know, she'd had a couple of the symptoms, but we were vacationing in Central Oregon. It was very hot. We're all thirsty and tired given sort of the situation. But unlike most probably dads, dad just happened to have one of these devices. It's called a glucometer. And so as she mentions, we did the blood test, and I expected to just sort of, you know, take that off the list of possibilities. And of course, it counts down 4, 3, 2, 1. And when it got to the reading of 310, it felt like I'd been stabbed in the heart. And so that was sort of my motivation to get back into the diabetes advocacy game, and it's been excellent. We actually, Katie and I, spent week before last in Washington, D.C. advocating for the national ADA, and there's some staggering numbers, Mr. Chair. In the last 5 years, the number of people with diabetes has actually increased 41%. There's now about 25 million people living with diabetes in the United States, about three times that, about 75 million when you consider what's called pre-diabetes. So these are the people that have some of the conditions that may lead to type 2 diabetes. Katie and I have both what's called type 1 diabetes, and of that population of 25 or so million people, there's about 3 million of us with type 1 diabetes. When you look at the costs of diabetes in this nation, it's absolutely staggering. We spend $245 billion a year on the care and treatment of both types of diabetes in this country. And this, again, is up 41% in the last 5 years. And this doesn't even include the costs of the acute and chronic costs of heart disease, stroke, kidney disease, eye diseases related to diabetes. So if you included those costs, it would be much, much higher. These are costs that state and federal taxpayers are paying, that individual Americans are paying, and that all of us who pay those insurance bills are paying. In Oregon, it's equally as staggering. We have about 240,000 known people diagnosed with diabetes in Oregon. That includes both types. Again, with the type that Katie and I have, it's probably somewhere between 15 and 20,000. But a total population of about 240 or so thousand Oregonians. And the cost that Oregon is paying, the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, the local taxpayers of the state of Oregon, the individual Oregonians that have the disease and individual Oregonians who pay the health insurance, is almost $3 billion. It's $2.99 billion. And these are numbers that just came out 2 weeks ago. 2.99. And again, if you include those costs like stroke and heart disease related to diabetes, it's probably closer to $4 billion. And so basically we're here, both Katie and I, and then you'll see a lot of people wearing red T-shirts behind us. And the people
with hands up.
Yeah. And a lot of people throughout the Capitol today. We're here just to bring attention to this issue to you, our policymakers. Probably all of you, all of us, are somehow affected by diabetes. But even if you're not, even if there's nobody in your family that has diabetes, you're still affected because you're responsible for the public purse string and $4 billion a year dedicated to diabetes. And because we don't have a cure, not going to other places where that $4 billion could be used is something that, you know, we want to impart on you is very important. So that's why we ask you to continue to do the work you're doing. Please support bills, the diabetes bills that are up this session that have to do with advocacy and awareness and testing. It's always a budgetary issue. There's always an issue of dollars and cents and how we're going to pay for this. But especially with type 2 diabetes, as much as you can prevent type 2 diabetes, it's one of those, you know, a few pennies investment has a few dollars worth of return on investment, and of course a few dollars that are not going out paying for that disease. So with that was kind of my whirlwind testimony. So much appreciate your service, and be happy to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Any questions? Representative Bruin? Scott, if you had one wish for us on the public policy side, what would that be?
You know, diabetes is a hard disease to understand by looking at she and I. My guess is when you look at Katie and I, we look pretty healthy to you. And we are, because we take care of ourselves. In that sense, diabetes is a very cruel disease. Unlike a lot of other diseases, you can see the ramifications. With diabetes, you often can't. And so my one request, Mr. Chair, is to, you know, if you know somebody with diabetes, ask them about it. Ask them about the challenges they have in any given day, because as Katie would tell you, it's not something you just you take a pill for and you forget about till the next morning. It's a 24/7, 365 disease. She and I are never not thinking about our blood sugars. We're never not thinking about what our blood sugar levels are. We're never not thinking about how many carbs are in whatever meal we're eating, because we have to dose that with the right kinds of insulin. And so because of that, my point to that is just, you know, if you know somebody, reach out to them and learn their story, not so much the stats, but learn their story and think. And if you would, you know, when you're talking about the bills that you'll be hearing, and when there's, hopefully there'll be no resistance, but if there is resistance, just keep that person in mind. So
I think the bill we have most quickly is a bill to deal with the cost of diabetes supplies for pregnant women with diabetes.
Yeah, the gestational diabetes, yeah. Of course, we would support that.
Well, or regular diabetics who are pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
It's that time during pregnancy where it's so important to keep things right.
Right.
Yes, sir.
If we're done with the serious questionings about the topic at hand, I just want to ask if this is the young... I missed your testimony, I'm sorry about that, but are you the young lady who helped us bring into existence the state crustacean?
That's actually my sister.
Thanks.
That was a serious question. Thank you so much
for coming. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for being here.
It's very important for us to be reminded of what the citizens of Oregon face on a regular basis. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee.
Thank you.
Very nice to see you again, young lady. Close the informational meeting on diabetes and probably start down the agenda. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2969. Administrator, will you talk to us about that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2969 requires insurers that provides coverage of ambulance care and transportation to indemnify the provider of ambulance care and transportation directly.
I have heard there is no longer any opposition to this bill. Mr. Hughes and I have talked about Aflac's position, and we think we've agreed together that until they actually start paying for specific health services, that it's not necessary for them to be exempted from this bill, that they pay for cash amounts to people under various circumstances not here. So I am willing to have a motion on this.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2969 to the floor.
I'm going to vote no on the amendment procedurally. I think there is some tweaking that may be necessary on that, and we can do it on the Senate side.
Well, we don't have an amendment in front of us.
Don't we? Oh, I thought we did have.
Well, there was a potential amendment.
Oh.
We decided that that wasn't needed.
Well, I would have voted no on the potential amendment.
Ah, yes.
That's what I get for showing up late. You know? Okay.
Okay, we have a work session in front of us and a motion coming on the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2969 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2969 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Unamended.
Unamended. In its pure form.
In its purest form.
Any discussion? Would you call the roll, please? Sure. I'm sorry.
Okay. I just was going to mention that I had some questions. I talked with some folks out in the hall. I'm not sure that I thought of every scenario that I was worried about. I'm going to vote for it here and then keep trying to imagine other scenarios that I'm worried about. And if I do, I'll let you know.
That's great. No, you don't even have to let me know. Just imagine. Well, vote your conscience. You're a great American. I remember hearing that.
I heard that. Yeah.
Yes. Would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Excuse.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Penner?
Aye.
Representative Whitey?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2969 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We should get Congress to carry that. No, let's not do that. Anybody want to carry that one?
I'll do it.
It's unlikely.
Sure.
It's unlikely to carry it. I close the work session on House Bill 2969. I'm opening up a work session on... it is a work session on House Bill 2132 for the purpose of inviting the people that didn't get to testify on it when we carried over, and I promised we would give them a chance to testify. I don't expect to move that bill today, but let's have, who do we have? Jesse O'Brien, David Berenberg, Nora Leibowitz, yeah. And then we'd have John Mullen after that. We need both of you? Yes, okay. Let's go.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien, healthcare advocate with OSPR, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We do not actually have a position on this bill, but we did sign on to a letter in support of putting together a work group to study this issue, and I wanted to just briefly explain why we feel that that's important and why we signed on to that letter. We feel that properly handling the issue of churn between Medicaid and exchange enrollment is critical to the long-term success of the exchange. And given the size of the population that's going to be churning in any given year, estimates say that it could be 60,000 people or more. That is a significant portion of the potential population that could be covered under the exchange. And the exchange will be more successful the more people get coverage through it. So we would really like to make sure that as many people wind up getting that coverage as possible. I'm very concerned that people may fall through the cracks, in part because they may just not get the coverage, but also in part because the coverage may cost too much for them. Even with subsidies, I'm concerned that these plans may be too expensive for a lot of the people in that churn population. And I'll say Cover Oregon, I think, is doing a great job with the tools currently at their disposal, and they've been very willing and open to work with concerned advocates on the issue. I really appreciated the conversations that we've had with them around this. But I do think that this is a good time to pull together some smart people to look into the full range of options for giving Cover Oregon and OHA more tools to handle this issue. Part of the reason why we don't have a position on the bill is that I'm not certain that this particular vehicle is the best solution, but I do think that there are a range of options for policy tools to handle this issue that could be that could really make a big difference. For example, I mean, some version of an auto enrollment structure like what's in this bill might work. The so-called basic health option in the ACA is another option to consider. There are also states that are looking into the possibility of what are called bridge plans that offer very low-cost private market coverage to people churning out of Medicaid. And I think that right now would be a great time to study what those options might look like in Oregon and see if any of them could be workable. I think there's a big difference between what we can accomplish in the short term to deal with this issue and what we can accomplish in the longer term. And I think that if there is a work group, we ought to consider both, because most critically, we need to get the exchange up and running, and we don't want to do anything that would disrupt the ability of the exchange to be up and running October 1 for open enrollment. Some of the potential solutions aren't even going to be available during that timeline, but they may be available in time for the next open enrollment period. And I think that getting the ball rolling on looking into those options right now would be a prudent step for making sure that the exchange succeeds in the long run. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee.
You can get questions now, or we can do it at the end of the panel, whichever. Just let me know.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Dave Barenberg representing Cover Oregon, and with me is somebody much smarter and more knowledgeable on the intricate policy issues, our Chief Policy Officer, Nora Leibowitz. First, I just want to thank Jesse for his involvement and those of many others who've served and put countless hours in providing advice as Cover Oregon is moving towards a reality and rolling out our enrollment plans in the future. So we thought that it would be useful for the committee to hear what it is we will be doing when plans go into effect in January and serving this population, and that's
David, what... can I interrupt just a moment, please? In case anybody's waiting for House Bill 2128, we are going to carry that bill over to Wednesday, so free anybody up that was waiting. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I would actually like to pass this over to Nora Leibowitz so she can provide the detail.
For the record, my name is Nora Leibowitz. I'm the Chief Policy Officer for Cover Oregon, which is Oregon's health insurance exchange marketplace. As David mentioned, we wanted to talk some about what we and the health authority have been doing to prepare for 2014, when many Oregonians, both Medicaid and CHIP eligible, as well as tax credit eligible, and others will be coming to the exchange for health insurance. So Cover Oregon really appreciates and shares the concern of the proponents of this bill that Oregonians who leave Medicaid retain coverage and, more importantly, access to care. Cover Oregon and OHA have been working together to make sure that the transitions between the coverage programs are as smooth as possible. And one of the big pieces of that is using a single eligibility system and the same set of rules. And we've been building, as we've built the IT system that underlies it, it's important to know it's not multiple systems. It's one place that people are going for these eligibility determinations. In addition, we are building on and expanding the OHA network that already exists of community partners and application assisters to make sure that applicants have the help that they need in the places where they live, work, and play. As a little background, I know that Rocky King has come and talked with you earlier in the session about the exchange. But just as the short version, hopefully, is that it is a health insurance marketplace where people will be able to make apples-to-apples comparisons about plans and, more importantly, be able to figure out what financial help they can get paying for coverage. And I wanted to talk about how what we're offering is specifically going to be meaningful for people who are moving between Medicaid and tax credits. So over the past year, Cover Oregon and OHA have been building an eligibility and enrollment system that is based on the state's Medicaid and CHIP eligibility rules and the new tax credit rules. This is one place to get eligibility determinations for all three. And the system will first ask people questions to help determine whether they're eligible for Medicaid or CHIP, and if they're not, it'll then determine their eligibility for tax credits. We anticipate that for many families, there will be some family members, particularly children, who will be covered by Medicaid or CHIP, and their parents will be eligible for tax credits because the eligibility for the Medicaid program and CHIP program for children is such a high income in Oregon. So for someone who has been on Medicaid, when they come to us, the system will first see if they're on it, see if this is the moment of their re-enrollment, and then if they are at their re-eligibility determination not still eligible for Medicaid, the system looks and sees what they're eligible for in terms of tax credits and then sends them a message about their new eligibility status. And
excuse me.
Yes.
You said that OHA is preparing a waiver that will make that determination only once a year rather than every quarter.
Yeah, and in talking to Bruce Goldberg, he said he wasn't even sure that we needed a waiver because if it's just the standard population that's at issue, when standard goes away, then the existing approval for other populations will be in action already.
But the intention is it'll only be a Medicaid income evaluation annually, not quarterly. So that'll really cut down the churn.
Absolutely.
Problem quite a bit.
Right. So everyone will be redetermined once a year rather than some people now in Medicaid who are determined quarterly. One of the key things is that there's a single notice for Medicaid CHIP tax credits, so people won't get, as they sometimes do now, a rejection or a notice that they're not eligible in one letter and an eligibility notice in another letter and sort of have that confusion about what does this mean. So it'll be a single letter. We're also working on what are the different ways that people want to receive notice, recognizing that some people are going to want to get things on paper, other people are more comfortable with getting it electronically and other means. So we're implementing processes and systems that will ensure Oregonians have the help they need. When someone is using the web portal or completes a paper application or gets in-person help, that everybody is going to have their eligibility determined using the same rules. One of the system has been designed essentially to draw people in to help them with the application and enrollment completion, both at the first year and at annual redetermination. So that includes what you could call passive redetermination, which is at the end of someone's year, they're getting close to redetermination. The system says, oh, this person is ready for a redetermination, they send them a notice saying, this is what we know about you from the most recent information we can collect. We have access not only to federal tax information, but also to local quarterly wage data, to unemployment, et cetera, Social Security. And we tell the person, this is the information that we've collected. So this, according to our sources, your income is this. If you have anything that is you think this is not correct, please contact us and tell us what is correct. If you don't contact us, we're going to do a determination based on this information. So there's the first opportunity for people to say, yes, this is right, or you know, they don't have to do anything if it's right, or no, I actually got a different job, or I lost my job. And then the either from the information that they that we've shown them or with amendments that they've given us, we'll do a redetermination.
All right, can I ask you to wrap up? I think we'll have time for this. It turns out we don't intend to move this bill, so we'll have time for an update on where you're going.
Sure.
Okay.
Our key thing is that the work that we've been doing with our partners at OHA, as well as with stakeholders in the community, is intended to help draw people in, to get to help them learn about their options, to learn how to use the system, to get help using it, as well as to make sure that they don't fall through the cracks when their eligibility changes.
Yes.
I would just like to understand a little bit more the timing involved here, because I understand it's proactive, so you're trying to identify these people before, in theory, before they lose coverage, I'm assuming what that is. But even so you send the notice now. I'm trying to understand what the time frame is and again, what the likelihood is that people are still going to end up without coverage during some part of that time just because of the time it takes it to occur.
This isn't about coverage. This is about subsidies.
Well, I understand that. But again, if they're eligible for the subsidy. But again, if they're going through this certification or verification, I'm just trying to understand what the, you know, how much time is that going to take from a standpoint of when this process starts to where they would know one way or the other. I don't know what the risk is to them if the subsidy, at some point they'll lose the subsidy in theory. So I don't know what the risk is until they reach a determination. I don't understand that.
No, they wouldn't lose the subsidy. It's more that if something has changed, the person, say, since we did a quarterly wage draw, which could be, you know, 3 months to 6 months old, depending on the information available, that if someone says, no, something has changed, and I want to tell you about this thing that's changed, it's an opportunity for them to update their information. The key thing is they don't have to know, they don't have to think, oh, right, 11 months ago, I signed up for this, let me go and do it now. We're reaching out to them to say, hey, now's the time, here's what we know about you.
Great.
Thank you very much. John Mellon, please. It is not our intention to move this bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Just very quickly about House Bill 2132, it's kind of been nicknamed the churn bill, and for those of us through the Oregon Law Center, this has never been the full discussion. As you may recall, some of you who were on the interim committee for healthcare, I came and testified on the basic health plan program option, and saying that we needed to look at issues of affordability, churn, and also continuity of care. So basically, in making some brief remarks today, I just want to say that I want to thank Oregon Primary Care Association for bringing the bill forward. In its current state, it's not complete or what I would necessarily like, but we did sign onto the letter, as did Osberg and others, to say that it really made sense to look at these issues and to have a work group and figure out what's going to be best as we move forward in the state of Oregon. We're all going 100 miles an hour. I think a little time out to talk about some of the consequences of these changes, about what happens about affordability, churn, and continuity of care would be welcome, and we would certainly be happy to participate in any way we could.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2132.
And I've announced we're carrying over House Bill 2128 until Wednesday.
Mr. Chair, can...
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to move to have him vote. He's not here.
He left again. Okay, well, we'll do it again.
We'll pick it up.
We're carrying that bill over. So we've got a pretty busy schedule Wednesday, but we have a little lighter schedule on Friday, so if we move the stuff out today, it'll make it a little easier. That will be carried over. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2714. Will you tell us about that, Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2714 authorizes a pharmacy to perform certain tests and examinations if that pharmacy obtains a waiver from the United States Department of Health and Human Services and complies with the applicable federal regulations.
Mr. Thompson, do you have any comments on this before we...
No, you know, it reflects back to years ago when we started working on whether or not pharmacies could do immunizations. And it was the same argument about can we open up healthcare to other providers to do other things in other venues. And eventually we did that, and now pharmacies are doing immunizations and there are no problems. 90% of flu shots are not given by pharmacies and whatnot. So, and this is the same thing. If it is abused, then there could be a problem, but with all the emphasis on cost control, obviously the pharmacy ethics and other control measures, you'd have to be stupid to grab this and run with it and think you're not going to get caught. So I think it's a good bill.
And we've been assured by the pharmacy board that they're comfortable with supervising this. And
I talked to them as well. And,
can I have a motion? Then we'll see if there's any discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2714 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. House Bill 2737, no, 2714 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnear?
Aye.
Representative
Whiteley? Aye.
Representative Whitener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenwood?
All right. Motion passes. 2714 to the floor. Would you like to carry that? Representative Thompson will carry it.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Conger to vote on House Bill 2969.
Representative Thompson moves we suspend the rules to allow Representative Conger to vote on House Bill 2969. Any objection? Your vote?
Aye. And thank you very much, colleagues, for being patient with me.
You're very welcome. Open up a work session on House Bill 2737, which has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Administrator, you want to talk to us about this one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2737 requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt standards and procedures to certify specified mental health providers to qualify for an insurance reimbursement and authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to adopt fee for such certification for applying for such certification and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
If you remember this was one that got lost when we split OHA from DHS, and it's a purely technical bill. There is no objection to it from anybody. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 2-2013 and the -2 amendments dated 2-2813 to House Bill 2737. Is that right?
Yeah, I want to see the dates. Representative Kenny Geyer moves we adopt the -1 amendments dated 2-2013 and the -2 dated 2-2813 to House Bill 2737. Is there any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2737 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves we adopt 2737 to the, send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation and referred to Ways and Means by subsequent referral. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Representative Flynn.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Harper.
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer.
Aye.
Representative Weigand.
Aye.
Representative Weigand.
Aye.
Vice Chair Penny Geyer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
And Chair
Freeland. Aye. 2737 on its way to Ways and Means. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2946. So Lawson, what's that one about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2946 repeals the sunset on the prohibition against dental service contract restricting price charged by provider for services not covered by the contract.
This is one. This is simply taking a sunset off a bill we already have.
That's correct.
Can I call Jill Price, please? Dr. Price, you join us?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jill Price, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association. I am both the current president of the Oregon Dental Association and a practicing dentist in Southeast Portland. In 2010, the Oregon Dental Association introduced House Bill 3665, a bill that prevents insurance companies from setting fees for services they do not reimburse for. The bill passed through both the House and the Senate unanimously. Unfortunately, because it passed during one of the February special sessions, a concern was raised about the unintended consequences passing a bill through both chambers unanimously in less than 3 weeks. Therefore, it was agreed that we would sunset the bill until January of 2015. House Bill 2946, introduced this session, simply removes the sunset provision from the 2010 legislation. The goal of this new bill is to ensure that dentists are able to provide each patient with the highest quality of dental care, that each patient and their dentist are able to make treatment choices that first and foremost protect the health and the well-being of the patient. Artificial caps created by setting fees do not change the cost of performing these non-covered services. Caps set below the actual cost of services put practices in a difficult position of shifting the cost to the patients in the form of higher rates for other services, forcing the dentist to figure out how to absorb the financial costs. We are not aware of any opposition or problems with removing the sunset. 28 other states have passed this legislation since our bill passed in 2010. We are simply asking the legislators to make this change permanent. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? And this was hard to believe this bill was needed. The insurance company could tell a dentist what they could charge for something they don't cover. But
how did we ever get involved in this? As a business person, I would like to know how I can get I can affect other people's pricing that I have nothing to do with. But you could do this everywhere and cause all kinds of. Why did we ever do it?
It's weird.
Okay.
Don't go away. We'll be back with you in a minute.
Okay.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2946 and get a motion. Oh, I'm sorry. Open a work session on 2946.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2946 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2946 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? This will be one for the consent calendar. Will you please call the roll?
Representative Flynn.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Harper.
Aye.
Representative
Kennedy. Aye.
Representative Weigand.
Aye.
Representative Weigner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Penny Geyer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
And Chair Greenlee.
Aye. House Bill 2946 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation and will be put on the consent calendar without objection. Unless there's objection.
It is Representative Clem's bill. I didn't know. He might want to carry it.
You have an objection. You get the bill.
I'm trying to not carry any of my own bills this session.
Oh, this is your bill. Okay, no. You agree it should go to the consent calendar?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Work session is closed on House Bill 2746 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2947. And Dr. Price, you're on again.
Okay. Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, again, Dr. Jill Price representing the Oregon Dental Association, I thank you for allowing me to speak in support of House Bill 2947. In 2011, the Oregon Dental Association spent considerable time and resources crafting Senate Bill 738, the result of which was a bill I think all involved could be very proud of. The Oregon Dental Association is supportive of the dental pilot projects that Senate Bill 738 allows for, but the rulemaking process revealed a mistake in the draft of the language concerning just one section of the pilot projects. In Section 15 of Senate Bill 738, the bill states, quote, "The Oregon Health Authority may approve pilot projects for community dental health coordinators." Several years ago, the American Dental Association developed a new member of the dental team called a Community Dental Health Coordinator, or CDHC, as we call it, to help expand the highly qualified dental care. A pilot for this new dental team member was what the ODA tried to achieve in Senate Bill 738. As a member of the dental team led by the dentist, the Community Dental Health Coordinator works in underserved communities where residents have no or limited access to dental care, setting a foundation for prevention in the communities that have yet to see the benefits of prevention. Community Dental Health Coordinators act as patient navigators who provide limited clinical services and help connect the patients to the dentist to provide the actual treatment. Unfortunately, the specific language of Senate Bill 738 states, quote, "Community dental health coordinators educate the community." According to the Office of the Oral Health, whose deputy AG reviewed the proposed rules for the bill, under the current language, the CDHC can only educate, not due to the necessary clinical component because there is no clinical reference in the statute language. Because of this language, this section of the statute does not allow for the American Dental Association's pilot project to be run through. Leadership of the Oregon Dental Association discussed changing the language to include a clinical component, but ultimately decided it made just as much sense to actually apply the community dental health coordinators through the current existing dental pilot projects language already allowed in the statute. So, although we are wanting to remove this section, this certain one section, Section 15, the intent of the CDHC can still be realized through Section 1 that is already written in the bill. This leaves the pilot projects intact. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
I have a question.
No idea.
Please.
Can you describe what the clinical component is?
Well, they go out and not just educate, and that's what it's written right now, is that they can only educate. But this person really helps navigate the system. So they're going to be doing hands-on education. They're going to be actually looking at the mouth, assessing what needs need to be done, where they need to be going to, and then they would actually help these patients get the treatment they need. If they just use the language educate, then they are physically not allowed to do a clinical examination. And these people are going to be trained in the fact that they can do clinical, you know, limited clinical care.
What is the training for them?
I don't know if that has been completely determined.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2947 and open up a work session on House Bill 2947. We have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2947 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2947 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Clem.
Aye.
Representative
Parker.
Aye.
Representative
Kemmer.
Aye.
Representative
Lively. Aye.
Representative Weidman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Penny Dyer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
All right, motion passes. Clem seems to be the dental expert in this committee. Will you be willing to carry this one?
Very good.
Representative Clem will carry it.
This isn't a consent item, huh?
Not quite.
Complicated.
Not quite. Close the work session on House Bill 2947 and open a work session on House Bill, a public hearing on House Bill 2948. And who do we have? Danielle Saucy and Patrick Rotz, please.
I'm getting there.
Can you tell us what it's about while they're showing up here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2948 authorizes dentists licensed in other countries to participate in educational activities related to dentistry that occur in this state. It authorizes dentists licensed in other countries to practice dentistry in this state without competition for limited duration, and allows those dentists to be granted staff privileges at hospitals located in the state upon written request by authorized officer of the hospital.
Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenick and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Dan Saucy, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association. I'm both the chair of the Government Relations Council for the Oregon Dental Association and a full-time general dentist here in Salem. And thank you for allowing me to speak today in support of House Bill 2948. The bottom line on this one is it's going to piggyback foreign dentists into a law that we already have in Oregon where you can come from another state if you're licensed in good standing and volunteer here in Oregon. We have a Mission of Mercy outreach thing, things like that. A group that I'm a member of, we have foreign dentists that come and that come to visit. And personally, I've operated in Vancouver, B.C., Portland, Oregon, UCLA, Scottsdale, Arizona, San Antonio, Lincoln, Nebraska, Minneapolis, Meharry in Nashville, Jackson, Mississippi, Morgantown, West Virginia, Gainesville, Florida, Parris Island, South Carolina, Loma Linda, University of Washington, Nova Scotia, Halifax, Nova Scotia, Indianapolis twice, and I did not go to the Hawaii meetings.
Only some of those are foreign, right?
Pardon me?
Only some of, they're not all foreign.
No, there were four times.
They were pretty foreign.
But the issue is the licensure and what allows me to go there. What I have, the only thing that I've ever done is provide my copy of my current license and my current malpractice status, or that I'm covered. We operate on patients in Oregon. If they were to come here, they would operate on my patients, and I'm watching over them. And it's sort of a safe kind of deal. It also, these are not wacky countries. It's Germany, Italy, Brazil, Japan. Modern countries. We use a lot of...
You get to vote on whether they're wacky or not.
Well, a lot of innovation comes from Germany, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, and this is an opportunity for foreign dentists to come and do... When I operate in these places, usually there are dental students hovering over looking at my technique and what I do, and that's what the gist of this law is, this proposed amendment. One problem with it is that, as introduced, the hospital granted staff privileges, that was not part of the intention. That's totally not related, and that's an amendment to take that off. There's an amendment to take that off. We're interested in allowing foreign dentists temporary license for the purpose of continuing education. Thank you again for your time.
We have that amendment in our possession.
Yeah, and am I happy to answer any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
Welcome,
sir. Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Patrick Brotz, the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. I'm just basically here to answer questions. We work with Dr. Saucy and the Oregon Dental Association. They came to us and said, here's what we'd like to do, and gave the proposal, and unfortunately there was just one minor mistake where it went a little too far in the hospital license area, and so we're here just to answer questions if there are any.
Representative Thompson.
So if a foreign dentist then came to OHSU or to the Oregon Dental meeting and was doing a demonstration on one of your patients, they would be covered under this?
Yeah. Okay. If they had malpractice,
right.
Current license,
yeah.
And another republic.
Right, yeah, right.
Which is something I've never done in any of these other places. We want to be tight.
They have to be a notary public?
Pardon me? They have to have it signed by, and it has to be submitted to the dental board 10 days ahead of time, and it's quite a hurdle compared to some of these places.
Is there any other questions? Thank you. And the dash one amendment simply deletes. You have the dash one.
Staff
right?
Privileges.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2948 and open a work session on House Bill 28. We have a motion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-6-13 to House Bill 2948.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-6-13 to House Bill 2948. Any discussion? Any objections? So moved. Motion on the bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2948 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2948 to the floor with as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Could you call the roll, please? Wait a minute. Is there?
Yeah, a quick question, Mr. Chair. With reference to the non-wacky countries that were mentioned, I think that is all covered under accreditation by the Commission on Dental Accreditation of the American Dental Association. Is that correct? There's not a list of countries here, but it's that association that makes a judgment call.
About wackiness?
Yeah, which countries are, or which institutions are approved?
I don't have any, there's no list that I know about. Yeah, which countries, okay.
Not just my little group, but continuing education organizations invite this thing and invite a noted speaker or somebody who does this thing, and it gives us a chance to see in Oregon how they technically do it, what instruments they use and stuff like that. There's no country that's not wacky. Primitive dentistry, some of these Indian YouTube things. That's not what we're looking
Canada,
at.
Canada, for example.
Most of our members are from Canada.
I'm just remembering the dentist I saw operating in a Bedouin marketplace quite a while ago in the region.
Are you doing pretty well?
No.
Do you take the shirts? No. Thank you very much.
Did it save money?
I think that's enough of the discussion. Let's have a roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenman?
Aye. Motion passes. Is this another consent calendar?
Marketplace.
Clem should carry it. You want Clem to carry it? You have your friends down here cheering for you. Consent calendar. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3099. Mr. Administrator, what do we got?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3099.
Madam Conger? Oh, that's Johnson.
That's right. Requires the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services to adopt standards and conduct examinations to ensure linguistic competence of healthcare facility, residential facility, direct care staff hired on or after January the 1st, 2014, and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Representative Johnson, please, and the constituent. Then we'll have the next two, Patty O'Sullivan and Jim Carlson. I need to apologize. I think I told you I'd do this first, and then I just forgot it. So,
Mr. Chair,
gave your constituents a chance to see legislation in action.
And I'm sure they've been thrilled with what they've witnessed. I'm sure
they have. Hopefully, they won't tell us.
Sausage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, I'm Mark Johnson. I'm the state rep for House District 52. House Bill 3099 comes to you as a result of some communication that I had with a constituent, which would be this gentleman to my left here, probably 6 or 8 months ago, I'm guessing. He lives in an assisted living facility in Hood River, and during the course of an evening had some difficulty communicating with some staff at the facility in a commonly understood language that in his mind and in his concern is that it created some potential health care concerns for him. What I'd like to do is let Mr. Dockham identify himself, share his testimony, and then I'll go from there. So with your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Dockham. I've lived for over 4 years in a 70-unit assisted living facility at 1795 8th Street in Hood River, excuse me. I am the elected chair of the facilities resident council. By the way, I am also a representative of the older generation of diabetics than you first heard from this afternoon. The incident leading up to this proposed legislation occurred some 10 months ago when, unable to fall asleep, I pulled the cord by my bed and asked the responding caretaker to have the med aide bring the blood glucose meter to check my blood sugars. Instead, the same caretaker came back with a pressure meter and cuff, proposing to take my blood pressure. With gestures and words, I repeated my request for the med aid and blood sugar meter. The med aid did finally come, but also proposed to use the equipment to take my blood pressure. I finally decided that my best chance was to ask them to call 911 for the ambulance crew. As they started to leave, I suddenly had visions of them never returning. So I anxiously motioned to them to stay and use my own bedside telephone. As the med aide stood frozen with my phone in hand, I suddenly realized that the next problem was she didn't understand the term 911. So I took the phone back and dialed it. My next mistake was to return the phone to her, when I also realized that the 911 operator was not understanding the med aid's limited English. I grabbed the phone back and explained my need and location. I then laid back in my bed trying to rest. When the ambulance crew arrived, they found that my CBG, its call level, was 51, compared to the perfect 100 and the lower range of 43 to 73, i.e. I was about 8 points above it. Throughout the night, I probably would have slipped even further. They gave me a medical solution to drink and left shortly before midnight, after my blood sugar level had risen back to 115. The irony of all this is that I am in assisted living only because I had passed out at home and was saved 12 to 15 hours later by a home health nurse who knew enough about me and my medical history to know that my car in the driveway meant I really was home and just not able to answer the phone. So she came in and saved me. It is also important to understand that at this time, I am fortunate to be above the average facilities resident in terms of knowledge of the needs for my health care. I would guesstimate that probably two-thirds of the residents where I live are senile, in the first stages of dementia, Alzheimer's, or have some other condition involving limited mental capacity. Would one of them get the blood pressure or blood sugar test if she or he had a heart attack and could only point at the site of pain in the chest or arm? And what happens to me in the future when I'm no longer able to dial 911? Obviously, those are the reasons I requested this kind of legislation and why my representative, Mark Johnson, along with the chairman, was kind enough to sponsor it. This is a very important beginning. The lack of knowledge of even the most basic medical terms are indicative of a much bigger problem, the absence of any real training for those mostly very young caretakers and medical aides who will be the first line of defense for your parents and grandparents and for me right now. On behalf of those of us living today, I hope you will see fit to take this very first but important step. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I know sometimes we kick around in this chamber. Is this a
solution looking for a problem or a problem looking for a solution. But I do believe that what Mr. Dockham outlines is a problem that can be a potentially a serious problem across the state as we have faced an increasingly aging society and increasingly diverse society as well, as we have then folks from different ethnic backgrounds, language skills, and so forth coming together in a healthcare provider network and so forth. So that's the impetus behind House Bill 3099. Now, as the bill was drafted, it directs the OHA and DHS to adopt by rules some basic standards and so forth, and then to make sure that those rules are implemented at the local level. Now, as you well know, anytime we direct any agencies to do anything, obviously they do come back, and rightly so, saying that there will be increased costs to them. And we've been sensitive to that. We have drafted some amendments that remove OHA and DHS from the active role, if you will, and try to insert the local health care facility into the active individuals who would have to modify perhaps what they currently do. I'm fully confident that you're also going to hear that that will add a financial burden to them. So, Mr. Chair, I'm coming back to you and say perhaps there is a way here to provide some sort of awareness-raising tool that could ensure that at least that these concerns are being thought of, that they are being at least verbally addressed at the local level to try to ensure that situations like this don't arise and that we aren't further putting the care of our seniors in condition that I think any of us, if we had loved ones or family members in similar situations, it might have concerns. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. We do have dash two amendments, I think, that are in front of. Is that correct? You all have the dash twos, which were at the request of OHA. There's also a dash one that Mr. Dockham had crafted earlier. That just, I'll let you, maybe if you want to walk me through that. Could we get those distributed, Greener? Could you give those to the administrator, please?
On page one of the printed bill, after line 15, insert. No. Health care.
Oh, is that the right one?
I don't think
so. Okay.
Say, while you're looking at that, let me say that I've heard some horror stories from my constituents about the staffing level in long-term care facilities.
Uh-huh.
And it's something that I'm beginning to work on as well. I mean,
oh yeah, those are yours. That's yours.
I think this is an issue, and we'll hear from Mr. Carlson from the industry in a bit. Be interesting to hear.
Go ahead and walk them through the dash ones that they're giving.
That's an interesting question, Mr. Chairman. It so happens that apparently my management corporation is ending a fiscal quarter right now. They have, I found the other day, and informed the residents at Monday's resident council meeting a week ago, that they have now reduced one shift from four caretakers to three. And they have now, I discovered yesterday, they have also directed that should an employee call in sick or whatever, that employee will not be replaced on call. That means, in essence, that the 70 or so people in my facility have now been reduced, last evening, six people, caretakers plus med aid, to four. And that means I discovered one person that did not get their shower. Now, the showers are weekly for most residents. And again, as I stated in my testimony, many, if not most residents, do not have good memories or knowledge. They don't know they're supposed to take a shower once a week or be given a shower. They don't know their clothes are supposed to be washed whenever. So they don't know. I had the same incident one evening when my insulin was forgotten for the bedtime insulin. And I was the only one that remembered it. And staff had to be called in, had gone home. I'm more concerned about these other people that don't have the knowledge I have, or myself when I don't no longer have that knowledge. That's all these are the amendments. Sub 3, a health care facility may be exempt from the requirements under sub 1 of this section with respect to not more than two residents of the facility who request a waiver of the requirement in a statement written in the resident's primary language signed by the resident or the resident's authorized representative. That would allow a specific circumstance, coincidentally, exists at my facility. We have an Hispanic speaking older fellow. He's a great guy. He rides an electric wheel car half a mile up the street to have coffee with his buddies. That's why he wants to live where I live. And that's why I want him to have at least one other friend, if ever, that stays there that speaks his language. About all he can say to me is good morning. That's it. He needs some other help. He's a great guy. And this would allow two people, but no more, to waive that requirement of language requirement, because it could be difficult, especially in smaller facilities with only, say, 10 or 15 rooms. They can't have around the clock people speaking three and four languages. The other part is after line 3, a residential facility may be exempt from the requirements under subsection 1 of this section with respect to not more than two residents of the facility who request a waiver in writing.
Okay, just to hear the rest of the testimony we have.
Yes, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Happy to answer any questions you may have, but I think it's, at the minimum, I hope it's an awareness-raising tool of a situation that I think exists, and my fear is it could get worse. No fault to the care providers and so forth. They're all doing a great job, but at some point, I do think the evolution of our population plus the aging nature of our population, I think, is going to continue to make this a more and more frequent and, unfortunately, a prevalent issue. So.
Well, there's a certain irony in this because much of what we're doing with cultural competence and healthcare has to do with non-English speaking patients and English speaking staff. The opposite is in this case, I expect long-term care is enough different that in terms of its labor mix that makes this real. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was thinking of exactly that same conundrum. But the other piece there, I think we have to tread lightly here, that we don't set up a requirement so that a care home will not accept people who don't, as an example, speak English. Because it requires them to have a non-English speaking staff member all the time, then of course the druther would be don't admit that person. Which, if you happen to be Russian, for instance, it puts them in a position you have to have a Russian-speaking caretaker on site, or don't take the patient. I think a question, the answer to that is pretty simple.
Don't take the patient.
Yeah. So we got to be real careful how we proceed. Understand exactly what you're saying, because I'm running that the opposite direction in some other medical situations. But we need a better level of communication or some way to interact differently. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I would suggest too that I know that there are translation services available, electronic translation services capability that could be employed that may not necessitate that you actually have to have an employee who would meet those criteria. Yeah. But I think there are ways in this day and age to ensure that linguistic
accommodation is what we need somehow. Yeah.
Thank you.
So you all heard a first version of the cultural competency bill, and I've been meeting with a group around that issue, and there's been a lot of work to date on cultural competency, improving healthcare. You just gave a good example of it, focusing on licensed providers, and that's where Oregon Health Authority has spent a lot of their past year is looking at that, but their plan is actually going forward to look at what do you do in terms of the facilities, healthcare facilities. So I think this is a very timely question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these dash ones mentioned the exemption that a healthcare facility may enjoy if it's a small number of residents. But what I'm not sure from the bill is who issues that exemption, because it kind of describes they may be exempt from the requirements, but I don't know who decides whether they get exempt in looking at the actual bill.
by the resident signing the waiver, I believe. Resident.
Follow up?
Yes.
So let's just work through practically. Forget the language of the bill for a second. How do we want this to work? If you've got two tie speakers, they could sign a waiver saying we don't need it, and then the facility doesn't have to do it if two of them sign it. But if there's three, then they have to have a tie speaking helper at all times.
My intention, sir, was to allow them to have two in the my facility's example for that Hispanic speaking fellow to have one other person that speaks his language, but on the other hand, to not let them get carried away with five or ten not speaking different English language, to allow them to waive. I can waive the liability if I want to live in a German facility. I can waive your liability, and I understand that not all employees will speak my language or understand.
Okay, maybe we can visit further on this. I'm not totally sure how this would work, so I don't want
to talk about it. We'll get some more testimony in a minute. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming all the way. We have Patty O'Sullivan and Jim Carlson. Yep.
Can we go first?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Ladies first.
Ladies first.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I wanted to bring some information in this bill to your attention and also give you some information about what's currently going on out there in hospitals and also in the Oregon Health Authority and the Office of Multicultural Health. First of all, I just want to explain how we're involved in this, and that is Section 1 puts Section 2 in some statutes, 441.015 to 087, which include hospitals as a healthcare facility. So if you only meant long-term care, that isn't what was done in this bill. It includes healthcare facilities as they're defined in 441.015. So some of the the things in this make no logical sense to hospitals because it talks about residents. We don't really have residents in our hospitals. We have patients. We also have our patients obviously come and go, so keeping people with a specific language on staff or even available in that hospital is not very plausible. I also wanted to explain a couple of things, and this, I believe, is for any healthcare providers. Within the last 2 years, we were the first state, Oregon was the first state, to adopt the certification for medical interpreters through the National Board. And in OHA, there is an Office of Multicultural Health, and they did that, and they've also gotten a grant to do some work around that, so that there is some standards now set, and people can avail themselves of going there and getting tested in certain languages and getting certified as a medical interpreter. And it wouldn't be, I'm not sure exactly how it works for hospitals, whether a person would get certified and then we would contract them. That sounds more plausible. And they would work for a company and they would have a certification in a certain languages. It could be one or more. It doesn't help the opposite of what this is about, which is what happened when it was an English-speaking patient and a other than English-speaking caretaker, if that's what happened. This is the opposite way, which is what we're normally used to working with, and that is having somebody comes in and they can't speak English, and what do we do with them? There's a couple of other things. CMS...
what do you do with them?
Well, and that's what I was going to explain, Chair Greenlee. We're heavily regulated, as you know, and CMS currently has, as a condition of a participation to be a hospital, has a code of patient rights. And while that doesn't specifically say you have to have somebody that speaks their language, it does require a hospital for a patient and the patient's family, because remember, many times in hospitals, the patients are not conscious or able to converse with you. And so it includes their families, and they have a right to know what's going on. They have a right to help plan their care if they're able to, or their family is able to. And that doesn't specifically call for an interpreter. However, under the Joint Commission, I will read to you what it requires. Sorry, I'm getting all this in little pieces here. So. The Joint Commission has standards for rights and responsibilities of the individual as well, and the hospital must provide information in a manner tailored to the patient's age, language, and ability to understand. The hospital provides language interpreting and translation services. So what really happens at the ground is that that especially our larger hospitals in the cities where there's a lot of other than English-speaking folks that become patients, is that we have interpreting services. We have them. They can talk to them over the phone. They may be there in the hospital. They may have people that have gotten their certification who are employees who can be called at any time to help interpret. So there's a lot of ways to do it. In our more rural hospitals, of course, we can't have, I mean, it's impossible because we have limited staff there anyway, and they also have a limited exposure to patients that speak other than English. However, you could have a major car accident in that area and have people in your hospital that cannot speak English. So, and I can't tell you today exactly what they would do, but I can find out for you what they would do. My guess is that they have a policy on that that would tell them what procedures to follow. So just to wrap this up on my behalf, I want you to know that it's not like we ignore people that don't speak English, languages other than English. We see them in our hospitals every day, especially in the urban areas or in a smaller area where, for instance, Woodburn typically feeds into Silverton Hospital, and they have a lot of Spanish speakers and Russian Old Believers. And so the culture around those areas and around those hospitals is very well known, but there's always going to be the outstanding exception to that. And I believe we try our best, as do schools and long-term care and everybody, to try to best communicate with folks. I just, as an anecdotal information, when I was a lobbyist for Portland Public Schools, we had 97 languages spoken in our schools. 97 different dialects. There's no way we could have had somebody on staff. And when we went to contract, we did have contracts with every language that we knew about. They had to sign in when they first got to our schools and tell us what their home language is, because the kids learn English pretty fast, but you have to communicate with their parents. And we typically went to churches where the immigrant group came in, and we worked with churches, and we had some of those folks on staff. What we were not allowed to do is use the child as an interpreter to tell the parent how they'd been cut in school, because sometimes the interpretation got lost. I digress, but it is an issue all over. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Mr. Carlson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We fully support efforts to promote cultural and linguistic competency of healthcare providers and direct care staff in Oregon. And I think, as Patty's just outlined, there's a lot of complicated issues that come up here. There's a number of things in the bill that give us great deal of concern. I think Representative Clem was starting to touch upon them, just in terms of, from a practical standpoint, how we could actually even begin to implement some of the requirements envisioned in the bill. But what I think we're also, you know, seeing raised here are a couple of important issues, which are, we live in a very multicultural society these days, and we also, when we're talking specifically outside of the
more traditional healthcare settings, so hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and others, where we're dealing with licensed and certified professional staff, Oregon has really built a home and community-based care service delivery model for our long-term care system. And almost 85% plus of all folks who receive long-term care services in the state receive them in home and community-based care settings. And those models were developed specifically to be non-medical, and we're using, for the most part, non-licensed staff. You don't have doctors and nurses and certified nursing assistants and others in those settings. And some of that was to create a more home-like community model of services, more of a social model of care. But some of that, quite frankly, was also done with an eye towards being more cost-effective and delivering services at a lower cost in a more cost-effective manner. It's been over 5 years in Oregon, for example, in our Medicaid program since there have even been cost of living increases for home and community-based care providers in the context of the state budget. So one of the primary concerns we have here beyond the practicality of how you would even begin to implement some of this would be literally how you would begin to finance some of this. I think we heard in this earlier testimony, it is very commonplace now in healthcare settings to be using the services, interpretive services from a number of different organizations that are available there. There's also some wonderful technology services available to help with some of these language barriers. But in terms of being able to 24/7 have proper accommodation, as Rep. Thompson indicated, there's some challenges, and we would have to think, I think, very carefully and step very carefully and deliberately if we're going to begin to address some of that. I will conclude by saying that under existing rules and regulations that the Department of Human Services have under licensing for residential care facilities, and assisted living facilities are a category of residential care, you do have in OAR 411-054-0070 language that requires staff who have sufficient communication and language skills to enable them to perform their duties and communicate with residents, other staff, family members, healthcare professionals as needed. We also have under existing Oregon State Board of Nursing requirements extensive for medication aides and certified nursing assistants. We have extensive language competency requirements that are both part of their competency evaluation, their skills test, if you will, as well as their written test, which must be completed and passed. Both of those are in English. So in order to pass those tests, someone has to be able to pass both the written and the skills competency evaluation in English when those are administered.
I mean, it shouldn't be a big surprise that 85% or 90% of your residents speak one language, that you might want to have staff that speaks that language. I think I hear you saying that that's what the regulations require.
Mr. Chair, what
and
the regulations...
So how are they enforced?
Mr. Chair, what the regulations require and for residential care facilities is that staff must be able to, quote, have sufficient communication and language skills to enable them to perform their duties and communicate with residents, other staff, family members, healthcare professionals as needed. And so that would speak to all languages. The reality is we deal right now across the state with maybe not 95 different languages, as we heard the example in the schools. We've got facilities throughout the state where we've got both residents as well as staff who speak a multitude of different languages.
But Jen, in this case, you're not speaking of having two Romanian patients or residents. I mean, this was a population generally English-speaking. How is that? That's obviously in violation of the regulation you just read.
I'm not, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what's in violation. You're talking about in the particular
In the particular case
it was without getting into the facts of that case and what would be agreed upon or what would be disputed, my understanding from conversing with the administrator in the particular facility is that the caregiver in question is fluent in English. Now, in terms of bringing that caregiver here before your committee to speak English to you wasn't something that seemed appropriate today.
No, it wasn't, but assuming the testimony is correct, And I'm willing to assume that, I mean, that he didn't call 911 because the caregivers could understand what he wanted. He called 911 because...
Mr. Chair, in an attempt not to, you know, get into just anecdotal evidence, I had a difficult time understanding the committee from the back of the room, and it wasn't a language barrier. It was just a difficulty in understanding as people were communicating. And sometimes even people who speak the same language can have challenges communicating. I think you heard testimony, which I would concur with, that a large percentage of folks we serve have cognitive impairment.
Jim, let me ask a question. Yeah, I hope the staff doesn't, though. So let me ask the question. How is that OAR enforced?
Mr. Chair, in terms of if you have an incident, and an incident generates a complaint or something where the state would be contacted and regulators would come out and investigate the incident, you would have an incident investigation. On a complaint, that complaint after investigation would either be substantiated or would be unsubstantiated. If, in fact, you found a provider that was in violation...
Is the answer to this complaint driven? Is that what you're answering?
If the state is not contacted or the provider does not self-report it, there would be no way for this. There would be nothing to trigger an incident investigation. The provider will trigger internal incident investigations, and there are duties to self-report. But I don't know that this rose to the level.
The answer is this is incident related. I mean that there. I mean you don't have to have somebody report that a building is a fire hazard. There's a way to check that. You don't have to report that a building's food processes are unsanitary. You have a way to check that. I'm asking whether there is a standard way of enforcing that OAR that you read to us.
So, Mr. Chair, until
somebody complains.
On regular surveys that are conducted by licensing authorities.
That's
so in the examples you just used, in the case of fire, the fire marshal conducts regular inspections. They also will respond in case of complaints or incidents. By the same token, regular licensing authority surveys will come out. They interview staff. They interview residents. They do document and chart review.
That was my question.
They are surveyed.
It's done by a regular survey.
Mr. Chair, that'd be correct. Or it could be complaint-driven. You have complaint surveys as well. And you also have situations where you have adult protective services workers who can come in and do an investigation as well.
Some other questions of these witnesses?
I just have one, Mr. Chair.
Matt? Yes, Representative Conger.
This is not, I think, core to the bill that's before us, but I'm dying of curiosity, and this is directed towards Patty. When someone comes into a hospital, you mentioned that you have interpretive services and things that you call. If you don't understand them, how do you know which interpreter to contact?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, of course, that is an issue, and there's some horror stories, not about a hospital, but about the state hospital, that go back to not understanding people or their dialect. Let me jump back to the 97 languages in Portland Public Schools, because that's sort of what I know. I mean, we had tribal languages. It's not just what language they're speaking, it's what dialect of that language, what tribe they come to. I don't have a good answer for you, but I need to go get that answer, because that's a great question. I think that they, you know, you don't know if it's just a matter of they're speaking Spanish and they don't understand. That's one thing. If they're speaking a dialect or a tribal language of an African nation, what you do is we tend to treat people. It depends on how they come in. If they walk in, they can point, we can try. If they come in an ambulance, we've got to figure out what's wrong with them and keep them alive. And so I think it would depend on the situation, how you handled it. But just walking in and walking up to the window, I'm not sure what they do. And that's a great question, and one I will find out. And I can either come back and talk to the whole committee or come and talk to you.
I'm sure nobody else is interested in the answer, but I was just really curious about what you do.
Send an email.
I will do that.
Representative Widener, you've been particularly quiet today. Because you were away and you're
figures
warming
because you
up.
Want to ignore me all committee, so.
Don't. Just speak out. Just holler out.
So. Jim, I'm just going to add a question. It's on this one here because when a person's diabetic and their blood sugar gets down at 50 is where we had testimony earlier, they're basically right on the bubble right there to where they're barely coherent. I was surprised that he was. I have a son who's diabetic, type 1. And I'm just wondering, are the staff supposed to be trained? Shouldn't they be able to see, they walk in and see he's got the chills or the sweats and know right then what they should be doing? Because at 50, he's got a lot of symptoms that should be exposed at that point. And I'm just wondering if in the nursing facilities, if they're trained to pick that stuff up.
Yes, so Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, in a nursing facility, which is different in terms of under federal and state regulations in terms of on staffing, you have RN care present 24 hours a day, so you have RNs and others. And so in such a case there, you would have an RN who is there. In home and community-based settings and residential care facilities, they're required to have RNs present for X amount of time during the course of the week, but you're not going to always have RNs present. So you've got non-licensed, non-residents, non-certified staff there. Generally speaking, in an urgent care situation like that, you're going to be looking at 911 calls. You're going to be looking at putting telephone calls into the physician or the on-call nurse on some of that. And, you know, there's always in these situations a certain amount of judgment there on do you have an urgent situation, do you not? By the same time, and as I know the chair and others know, while we're talking about healthcare reform and the like, and a lot of what we're talking about is there's tremendous pressure amongst providers to not be making inappropriate emergency room transfers or hospital transfers. And so there's rarely black and white cut and dried situations, but what generally speaking training would be in such situations would be to call 911 and to make a transfer. If it's an urgent care situation.
I follow up? Because my concern here is, I mean, you had somebody close to going into diabetic shock coma. And we had an incident, and probably most people in this room heard about the incident in Bakersfield. And I don't want Oregon to end up like that situation where here you have a woman having a heart attack, and they say we're not authorized to give CPR, even when they're asking them to do it. And everybody just stands around and watches someone die. Are we sitting in that situation? Because he actually had two people here, couldn't communicate with him at the time, and he was ending up calling 911 himself. So is there anything we need to do so we don't end up in this situation? Because this is not a good place for us to be, and we shouldn't be here having this communication right now, is how I personally feel.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, not knowing the complete facts of the situation here today, what I can tell you is you can train to situations and protocols, you can have standards, you can have regulations, and then we need to make sure that we're smart on the regulations we have. We have to make sure we have correct standards. We have to make sure that we've got good training that's in place and that folks are then operating within those, you know, within those guidelines.
And you have minimum wage employees with high turnover in the in these staffs. I mean, it's really not an easy.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Chair, in all fairness, we are not in a situation where we can have physicians present or registered nurses present in all situations at all time unless we're in a situation where we have unlimited resources to devote to those types of services. And so there are trade-offs when you build a system around home and community-based care service delivery.
I think we, at least the sense which I was interested in this bill, I don't think we're asking for that. I think we're asking a minimum that the staff can communicate with the patients.
Yeah.
And that's not with the odd Romanian who happens to show up. I just picked that because there are so many Romanians involved in residential care treatment in Multnomah County. But, yeah, I mean, it seems to me that's the question. The ability to communicate with the staff is something that ought to be evaluated and I think that's enough for today.
Thank you.
We'll continue this conversation. Just, I know there's DHS and OHA representatives. Anybody want to comment on this before we move on?
Okay.
No is the answer. Smart guy, Mickey.
Any language.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3099.
Yeah, it is.
I would think and unless we hear otherwise, we are adjourned. Come ready to work on Wednesday.